Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus' local site, covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes or our Blog Talk Radio page by searching for the Catbird Speaks. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Hey, Colin. How's it going?
Good. I am in Illinois for once. I am out of the 110-degree humidity of Texas. And
oh, wow.
I'm going to a White Sox game on Thursday as a fan for the first time in, shit, I don't know, 4 years. So pretty excited about that. What's up with you?
I am wearing my Josh Donaldson jersey, as we were talking about. And I recently booked plane tickets to Chicago for my 30th birthday is coming up in September.
Nice.
So I'll be catching one of the Royals are in town that weekend. So always a good opportunity to get really mad. And but yeah, I'll be catching a White Sox game at Guaranteed Rate Field. Which, by the way, my wife, like, she saw that pop up and she was like, "Is that seriously what it's called?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, "That's such a bad name." I'm like, I know. Guess what their logo is? Like,
yep.
It's so bad. So I'll be catching a game that weekend. It'll be my first time at the White Sox home park since 2013.
I think that's about the same time for me, actually, around there.
And that was also a Royals game. The White Sox, I don't think, scored a run.
The last game I went to at U.S. Cellular Field at the time, of course, was about a month before I moved to Texas. I was like, I got to get here one more time with my dad before I move, and I went to White Sox Rays, and it was Eric Johnson's last start of that season.
Oh.
He got shelled for, I think, like 6 runs in 2 innings. And then the White Sox came back and Jose Abreu hit a walk-off grand slam. So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty great. Yeah, yeah. I see that Eric Johnson hasn't thrown an inning this year, certainly not in the majors.
Didn't he have TJ?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. So who knows if he'll ever be heard from again. He's in the right organization to break in, that's for sure.
That's definitely true.
But, yeah, I think until – I went to 2 of the 3 games at Yankee Stadium this year. But it broke a stretch of, like, the White Sox scoring 1 or 0 runs or something like that in games I'd been to because, like – like, they got shut out by Harvey, like, his last good start when Quintana lost 1-0, like, Memorial Day the other year. And I was at Harvey and Hector Santiago's pitcher's duel. Harvey was, like, an Alex Rios infield hit away from a perfect game.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and then I think that, like, you know, it's just – I don't get to see the White Sox live too often, and they aren't big on scoring runs when I do.
Yeah. So. I didn't go to as many games as most of our Chicagoan friends growing up in Rockford. You know, it was like a 2, maybe 3 times a year venture. But it was always – I mean, I saw some awesome games at the time. I saw them beat the Red Sox in like 18 innings the day before the All-Star break in 06 when Javier Vasquez pitched in relief because it was the day before the All-Star break and they went 18 innings. I saw Jose Valentin hit a walk-off homer against the Cubs way back in the day, you know.
Oh, wow.
It's nice to, like, I used to go all the time, and now it's like the last couple times I've seen the White Sox live has been when I've been credentialed, like in Houston last year and in Arlington just this past weekend when I was there. So,
You know what? I was at that Houston series also.
Oh,
I wasn't credentialed. I was just there with family.
Yeah,
and you're right. That did actually – that broke up the streak as well because they had a good showing in that series as well. So I totally lied.
I forgot you were at that Houston series too. I don't know how – I mean, that's when we – the only time we've ever actually met in person.
Yeah, that was a good time. Minute Maid's a nice place to catch a game.
It is. It reminds me a lot of I don't know if you've ever been to Miller Park in Milwaukee, but it has the same feeling as that ballpark, and I like Miller Park a lot too.
The roof was closed. Otherwise, I might have compared it a little bit to Camden in Baltimore. But that makes sense because I feel like after Camden came out, a lot of organizations ripped them off. And last memory you triggered for me, let me see if I can – track this down. I was at, I'm trying to find, here it is, the June 17th, 2000, Cal Eldred start against the Yankees, where he left with an injury, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
And the White Sox got ahead like 10 to 3, I want to say. Yeah, 10 to 3, and then held on to win after a rain delay 10 to 9.
Nice.
And, yeah, 2000 was – that was such a fun year.
I used to go to White Sox Yankees every year in Chicago because I had one of my best friends growing up was a huge Yankees fan, and I got to see some pretty cool White Sox Yankees games then too. Like I saw Esteban Loaiza won his 20th against the Yankees in
– That's a good one.
03, that was the Loaiza year, right?
And yeah, that was his huge year, yeah.
Yeah, and then I was also at the start where they hit 4 home runs in an inning against Randy Johnson when Randy Johnson was with the Yankees. So
oh gosh, what year was that?
I think that was 06 also. It's either 05 or 06. So, Chris Widger was one of the guys who hit a homer in that inning. So it was around then.
Wow. Okay, because yeah. The White Sox did that a couple times, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Because they had a 4 homers in a row streak. Because I remember I think Toby Hall was the 5th guy up, and he was like, yeah, I was definitely grinding my bat to sawdust, swinging for the fences.
Maybe it was Toby Hall who hit that homer. Maybe that's the instance. I was a backup catcher. I know that. So I might be getting Chris Widger and Toby Hall mixed up. But
I have to Google it now. Pierzynski, Alexi Ramirez, Diane Vicieto, and Jordan Danks.
Which
looks like.
That was the,
is that, was
the
that in
one
a row?
Against Randy Johnson?
No, this is 4 homers in a row. Oh, sorry. There's a 2008. What am I missing here? 4 homers in a row. Here's the website with all of them. Are you talking about in a row or just one inning?
In an inning. I think there was one batter between. I think they went back to back to back and then batter and then.
Colin, who cares?
There was a homers batter in an inning. Come on. That's cool. And it was against Randy Johnson.
I'm joking. This was against the Royals in 2008. Tommy, Canerico, Alexi, and Juan Uribe homered in a row off of Bud. Joel Peralta and Robinson Tejeda. But that segues nicely to present day. Not at all. It doesn't transition at all. It's still about the White Sox, I guess. But we're coming off of a doubleheader last night against the Twins that provided, you know, some positives and some negatives.
Yeah.
I would say.
I think that as much as you can take from start, I think that the concerns about Carson Palmer, his rough season in AAA, translated right on over to his brief big league outing last night. I know James has written about it. I think he wrote about it today or last night, and it's just if you would have said a year and a half ago, like, oh, your first round pick this year. Or last year, 2 years ago, whatever, is probably destined for back end of the bullpen relief, we'd have been like, oh, shit, that sucks. And it does still kind of suck that seems to be the direction he's headed, but it's not as big of a concern. But, I mean, is that what you see? I mean, that Palmer maybe just a reliever?
Yeah, it's – so what's weird about Palmer is, like, you see flashes, right? I mean, to me, if I'd be concerned about his height, you know, he's 6 feet tall. He's not the 6'3", 6'4", build.
Yeah.
The ideal starter would, certainly from the right side. The concerns would be, what, that he couldn't get enough velocity, that he couldn't hold the velocity, that he'd get hurt. Those would be the concerns to me, or that he'd have to be max effort to get his good stuff, which is something that seems to be a concern for him. And those things all sound relievery to me. I mean, I don't think just because someone's short, they can't be a starter. I think that's overstated. It was crazy. I was listening to the Baseball America podcast about the 2018 draft class the other day, and they were talking about how, you know, Nick Madrigal looks really great, but he's 5'7", and that would be hard to persuade somebody to take at number one. And, you know, I get that why that's still a thing, but he's a middle infielder. Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't like using exceptions to attack rules. I mean, here's
like
a nerdy
Altuve
old...
Altuve or something.
Yeah, because Altuve is obviously like an anomaly. Yeah. Ditto. I mean, but Benintendi is a guy who recently, you know, probably should have gone at or near the top, you know, higher up on that draft. So the idea that shortstop being 5'7 is precludes him from being, you know, that would be the only reason people wouldn't go for him. That feels a little weird to me. in this day and age, you know, the expression "the exception proves the rule" actually means the opposite of what people think it does.
Yeah.
The exception proves the rule. Prove mean in the old usage of the word meaning tests the rule, i.e., is this a great rule if there's an exception? But anyway,
I didn't actually know that. I've been using it wrong forever. So thanks.
Yeah. Thank my mom and her degrees in old fashioned English stuff. But yeah, and her being super pedantic with me as like a very young child. But yeah, his height in and of itself doesn't deter me from, that's not the only reason, but it's, the problem is that, like, yeah, he had a 1-2-3 first inning. It looked like his velocity was falling off in this disastrous of his second inning that he didn't get out of. What was scary to me was even when he was, you know, he was throwing 95, 96, certainly at first, but he would, even when he got to two strikes, like, he could not throw a ball past a guy. He just couldn't.
He was not missing bats.
And he was getting, you know, these were not elite hitters either that started this rally against him. I mean, he got ahead on two strikes on like Kendrys Vargas, I think. And, you know, it was a sub 300 on base percentage and he couldn't put him away. He fouled off in the pitches.
Vargas is a quad A hitter, you know.
Yeah. And it's just troubling to me that even when the velocity looked good, like he wasn't fooling anybody. He threw one really good changeup in the first, I think, or maybe it was early in the count against Vargas. And his breaking ball looked kind of loopy to me. It didn't look sharp at all. And he couldn't throw the four-seamer past anybody, even though it said he was averaging, you know, 94 on it last night. So I just don't – that's really troubling to me.
Yeah, 94-95 doesn't mean as much if it's not missing bats, if it's flat. You know, it's like any – you know, above average hitter can hit 94, 95. It's got to have movement, or it's got to be, you got to use more deception, or, you know, really be hitting your spots. 94, 95 doesn't mean as much as it used to, because guys can hit that and guys have been able to hit that. And that's Fulmer's issue, is he's not missing the bats with it.
Yeah. And it just scares me that, you know, there's some guys where their stuff like plays up or plays down based on, and we've learned a lot about that stuff, sort of stats confirming old timey baseball wisdom, right? Like deception out of the hand, like extension, good movement on the pitch, ability to command it. And then there's sort of net effect of like, is the hitter actually concerned or not sure what you're going to throw up there? So if he doesn't think you can throw your breaking ball for a strike, he's going to sit on your fastball. And even though Fulmer missed on some close pitches yesterday, I mean, at first I was kind of encouraged because I was saying, oh, look, he's throwing it either right on the corner or right off the corner, which is a good sign. But he couldn't put anybody away because they just sit on the fastball because he can't throw his breaking ball for a strike. And then, you know, eventually they're going to kill his okay fastball. And then there's other concerns like, you know, maybe it's flat, like you said, or maybe, like I was saying, he doesn't get much extension on the ball. You know, you look at David Robertson is a good example of this from the recent White Sox guys, or Jose Quintana, where those are dudes who are throwing 92, 93. Yeah. But they bully people with their fastball. Mm-hmm. They have no problem pushing really good hitters around with their fastball to the point where, remember, Josh Donaldson was like upset that the team couldn't hit his velocity,
yeah,
Quintana's velocity. But it's like, if it moves and you can locate it and it's hard to pick up out of the hand and you get good extension on it, which I think Robertson and Quintana are both really good at, then it plays way up. Whereas, you know, like Jason Marquis threw really hard. It didn't really matter. Like Joe Kelly throws really hard.
Yeah, I mean, you can. There's any number of, you know, failed starters or even failed
Scott
relievers.
Linebrink.
Yes, exactly. Really so, and with Fulmer, it's like, because of how much he struggled at AAA this year, I think it's more concerning. We're like, you know, if Reynaldo Lopez had just completely bombed one of his starts before getting hurt, or even if Giolito gets bombed tonight in his White Sox debut, you know, that's less than ideal. And I don't know how much we want to talk about Giolito, since most people are going to be probably listening to this podcast after he starts tonight. But there are certain growing pains that people are going to go through, and you're more concerned with the process than the results with guys like these, and seeing that they're doing the things necessary to like advance their development. And with Fulmer, it's a little bit different because there are already concerns, and these concerns just become elevated the less and less he's able to perform.
Yeah, that's part of why I was a little surprised that he was the guy who was getting called up, because...
Well, I think it just had to do with 26 man and his AAA start schedule probably lined up with it. It could have been Danish if it were a different day. It could have been whoever, you know, but it's just Fulmer probably was due to start at AAA on Monday or whenever. And that's my assumption. I haven't read anything, but since it was 26th man, that's probably a solid guess.
I know doubleheaders do weird things with call-ups and shouldn't read too much into it, but you know, Han did come into the year saying, like, I don't want to call up any of our top guys unless it's to stay.
Yeah.
And, you know, you suspected even when Giolito got named as the 26th man that, barring incident, he was going to stay up.
Mm-hmm.
He's pitched well in AAA for some time now. If he's done what they've asked, you know, you like to reward the guy. And there's room in this pitching staff to like make a space for him, even if Ronaldo Lopez hadn't gone on the DL, which they probably suspected he would at the time. So Giolito being called up, like, I don't think is a surprise. I don't think it's unfair to say that he was probably going to stay up regardless, but it makes you wonder that if they think Fulmer's a guy who you can call up for a doubleheader and then send back down, does that mean they've downgraded him internally? I don't know. Or is it just purely his throw day lined up? Maybe that's all it is. But it just feels, I don't know, they've got guys that they felt totally comfortable using in the rotation in the bullpen all year. Like, they've got Holmberg in there who got a bunch of starts this year. They have Pelfrey, who got a bunch of starts this year.
Now back.
Yeah, like, those guys aren't good, but, you know, you could just as easily call up maybe have to do something with the 40-man for this, but... you know, Mark Lowe or Gene Mackey, you know, you got major league experienced relievers down in AAA. You could call up and then slide one of those bullpen dudes into the rotation instead.
Yeah.
So is the fact that Fulmer is getting the Tyler Danish, Chris Beck treatment isn't super encouraging.
Yeah.
And his ERA was almost 6 in AAA. Like, I know that minor league stats aren't everything, but if you can't get dudes out in AAA, like, I don't... Sure, the Charlotte defense isn't as good as the White Sox defense, but, like, I don't know, man. What is Kenneth Vargas hitting AAA?
Are you looking that up right now?
I am looking it up right now.
I mean, he's a high strikeout. Like I said, he's like a quad A hitter, you know?
He is a quad A hitter. He doesn't even hit that well in AAA. I don't know if that bolsters my point or weakens it, frankly. I don't know. But, like, it's weird. I'm trying to figure out why Fulmer, other than just it lined up that day, because you know what I mean? You could just as easily call up a reliever and slide one of those former starters back in the rotation.
Yeah. Holmberg's in AAA right now too, isn't he? He's not with the major league club, I believe.
Oh, I don't even know.
So he could have come up and been the 26th man. I think they sent him down maybe when Ronaldo came up or something like that. But I mean, we're starting to see, I mean, just kind of to the larger perspective, we are starting to see these guys. We got a decent two-start look at Reynaldo Lopez before he went down with the injury. Well, I don't know how decent the second start was, which I was at. You know, there are still some legitimate concerns with him about whether or not he's a starter. It's just so, like, it's so helter-skelter with him because, like, you definitely, even more so, you mentioned that Fulmer showed flashes. I think Lopez absolutely shows elite bat-missing stuff. It's just whether he can hold that for a starter's workload. And I don't know, I mean, it's obviously such a small sample size, but I don't know if we've seen anything yet that 100% alleviates that concern with him.
I'm not sure. I mean, his injury is, you know, he strained a muscle at the end of a full season. I don't think there's too much cause of concern for this injury necessarily. I mean, he was trying to pitch through it. But yeah, to your point about bat missing, you know, he struck out a batter an inning in over 50 innings of major league work in his career.
Yeah.
He's 23. He throws crazy hard. His off-speed stuff is promising. And he, in a way, you know, his command isn't great, but you know, you look at, you know, a guy like Fulmer, like last night,
yeah,
and contrast it, and you'll see the you know, Lopez is the same height as Carson Fulmer. It's just that his stuff is just much better. I don't think that we were going to get any definitive answer one way or the other is can Lopez be a starter?
Yeah.
This year, even if he shoved in September, and it's a short sample. I think that, you know, if he comes back healthy and finishes the year healthy, there's no reason to think he can't start the year in the rotation next year.
For sure. I mean,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they're going to give him every opportunity to be a starter. And, you know, we obviously hope it happens. And like you said, it's not going to – we weren't going to get an answer to that question this season. They're going to – I would assume that all of the indications are that they hope that both Lopez and Giolito are starting the season in the rotation next year. This is just kind of a get your feet wet opportunity. Let's see it a little bit so we get, you know, because I mean, people forget that, like, you know, we're watching MILB TV and seeing the highlights and stuff, and that's what the coaching staff's doing too. They're not down there in Charlotte, they're not down there in Birmingham or Winston-Salem. You know, it's something that it's easy to forget. Like when we were talking to Don Cooper about both Lopez and Giolito on Friday, when the news about Giolito coming up was announced, and he made reference like, oh, you know, I've seen some video of him in AAA. And obviously their reports are a lot more detailed than stuff that we're seeing and reading, but still the fact that, you know, having a month and a half where the coaching staff and the management can get their eyes on them and work with them directly for the first time since spring training, that's probably more the point of these late season promotions than anything else.
Yeah, they do get to work with the major league pitching staff or pitching coordinators and stuff like that. And there's value there, and they get, and you learn something going against major league hitters, I'm sure. Like, I'm sure even if Lopez finishes the year with an ERA of 6 over, you know, however many innings he winds up throwing, who knows when he comes back from his oblique back, whatever you want to call it, soreness. He's still going to learn, especially a guy who's got really good stuff. It's like, okay, well, what can I get away with against the highest level of competition? What can't I get away with?
Exactly.
And what approach works for me? And, you know, learning about sequencing and working with, you know, Kevin Smith is pretty well regarded as a guy who's like working with pitchers, at least so far, even for a guy without a ton of major league experience. So there are definitely benefits to this beyond, you know, and from an evaluation standpoint, you know, I've heard, you know, even on the BA podcast, which I recommend listening to, you know, even within the same organization, for example, you have your amateur scouts who are doing all the legwork and research for your draft. And then after your draft, your pro scouts are, you know, looking at these guys. And sometimes your amateur scouts love a guy, and then you get to the pros, and the pro guys are like, what the hell were they seeing? Like, that happens sometimes within the same organization.
Yeah.
So it could be that, you know, even though I think Dotson and Cooper are very much on, Richard Dotson, the minor league pitching coordinator, I think his title is.
Yes.
I think they are try to stay on the same page as much as possible. You know, people see different stuff. They have different opinions. So yeah, gets more eyes on him and have a better educated guess as to where he should be next year, what he should be working on in the off season, and all those good things. I'm still very positive on Lopez. Fulmer, I was, you know, for a long time I was saying like, okay, you know, of public outlets, it seems split. You know, a lot of people say reliever, a lot of people say, you know, I still see a starter in here, and I was willing to let the White Sox track record and development be the tiebreaker. You know, I was like, okay, well, deferred to the White Sox ability to get the most out of guys that other people have second thoughts. But people thought Sale was a reliever.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like
for a long time.
And it's a safe call, by the way. Like if you call most minor league pitchers, it's like, oh, I see a reliever though. It's like, yeah, you're going to be right most of the time.
Yeah. For sure, and a lot of elite relievers started. I mean, you look at like Wade Davis and Zach Britton. You know, that was
they were so bad as starters.
Yeah,
so bad,
so bad. but they came up. They were top prospect type pitching prospects, and you know they became elite relievers. There's value in that. It's obviously you would rather have a mid rotation starter than an elite reliever as an outcome from your top 10 first round pick type talent, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I mean,
and there's degrees of elite relievers too, right?
For sure. And you would rather that, I mean, it's almost kind of like a fallback plan, if you will, where it's like, well, at least he's still valuable to our bullpen, and it's better than, you know, you get a lot of pitching prospects who just flame out entirely. And if Fulmer or Lopez, if he falters or whatever, just turns into that, it's not the ideal outcome, but it's not nothing, you know.
No, I mean, we started this podcast talking about Eric Johnson, and he was a dude where a lot of smart people thought, hey, this is a number three starter, and it's pretty bankable. And obviously injuries change things, but even before his Tommy John and things like that, there were serious performance issues and his stuff fluctuated all over the place.
Oh yeah.
Fulmer threw a 1-2-3 inning on 7 pitches. His velocity to me was fading, as he approached, you know, the end of a very hard second inning and got yanked. But he did throw that first inning, and maybe, you know, if you can get 3 outs, then, you know, you got a major league career.
And I think Kevin Smith had the quote, I think it was either in James' story or maybe he just told it to us, that he said he has a closer's mentality. He comes out every inning and wants to strike everyone out. It was like, you know, just kind of like an accidental hint that's actually what he's better suited for.
You're not supposed to throw the cards on the table just yet.
Yeah.
Had a weekend in with the White Sox, and you had that great piece up on Lurie Garcia. I don't know if there was any if there were any other conversations you had or observations that didn't make it into that piece that you wanted to share, because I know did you cover. You were at 2 games?
I was at Thursday's and Friday's game, yeah. Well, the one thing that I really tried to elicit in that piece is that anytime you ask someone about Lurie, and, you know, we talk about small sample size with baseball players. Well, I'm talking about a small sample size as a reporter, too, because I'm not in the clubhouse with the team every day. But, like, anytime I asked someone about Lurie, they just, like, would beam about him. Like, everyone is just like so proud of him. He's like their little brother. I got that impression from both Jose Abreu and Elvis Andrus, who I spoke to, because I just thought it was really interesting. Like, and one of the things that didn't make it in the piece was I asked Lurie about coming up with the Rangers organization and about, you know, kind of coming up behind Andrus and like getting to learn from him, who is only, you know, 2 or 3 years older than him, but obviously was a lot more well-regarded prospect, and also learning from Adrian Beltre, who's obviously a Hall of Fame talent who he spent time in camp with and stuff. And he talked a lot about, you know, learning from those guys and just like them being like the model of what a major league player is. I know Elvis Andrus isn't like an elite player, but he's had a really successful major league career, you know.
And I guess now that he's hitting for power, maybe we need to reassess.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of came out in his career like on fire, and then the Rangers gave him that huge contract, and he had several years there of below average offense, and his defense didn't quite live up to what people thought it was when he initially came up.
Right, and I mean, I think it was a lot of it too. He was so young when he came up. You know, he came up at 20, and he looked good. And they were like, "Well, if he, you know, improves from here, as one would expect a 20-year-old to do, then he's a superstar." And then he just kind of stayed the same for a while. And now, at age 27 and 28, his hitting's taken a step forward, which, you know, he's been around for an eternity. I've certainly been. I was very vocal about how I didn't understand that extension and not trading Profar. Like, those seem like mutually exclusive things to do, especially when they had Kinsler still kicking around for forever. So that was all, you know, that was all going on. But Andrus has, if he's stepped forward with the bat, they are not going to regret that contract one bit.
Yeah.
So,
But I guess the really interesting thing when talking to everyone is, you know, I write for Baseball Prospectus, which is an analytics website. I, to a certain extent, am a baseball analytics writer. So I was trying to dig deep and get like, oh, did you change your stance? Did you change your approach? You know, how did you become a above average major league hitter when for 300 and something plate appearances, you were a really bad major league hitter, like really bad. I didn't phrase it that way, obviously, but sure. All I got from everyone, and sometimes it might be this simple, is just that, you know, he started to get reps. He started to get that regular playing time and he started to get comfortable. The big concern that everyone had about Leary when he was coming up is if his bat was going to, if he was going to hit well enough to stick on a major league roster. And for the longest time, I was like, well, it seems pretty true. Like, he can play all over the field, and he can play all over the field well. You know, his defense has always lived up to the expectations, but his bat was just dreadful. It was like, you know, the guy I always think of as the guy who was able to stick around as a all-glove, no-bat guy is Brendan Ryan. And I'm like,
yep.
You know, he couldn't even hit like Brendan Ryan. For a while, you know, it was,
yeah,
you know, of like a 420 OPS coming into the season for his career, something like that. And it has just clicked this season. And it seems just as simple as, you know, he's become more familiar with major league pitching, that he's feeling more comfortable at the plate. He's being more selective with his swings. And so that when he is swinging, he's making more contact. You know, he seems like a real student of the game. He's the kind of guy who is always, you know, studying the pitchers, and he just is more comfortable at the plate than he's ever been. And that, along with his versatility, has made him an asset who, you know, he's not going to be one of the superstars on the next White Sox team. If all of these prospects come up and do what they're supposed to do with Moncada and Eloy Jimenez and Rutherford, and, you know, if you want to go down to like Jake Berger and Zach Collins, ideally for the White Sox, those guys are going to be the core of the next White Sox winner. But winning teams also need the Leury Garcia types. And if he's proved that what he's done with the bat is legit long term, he becomes an option to fit that role going forward. And I think that's a pretty big deal.
It's a huge deal. You know, Leury Garcia, let's, like you say, if this bat is real, let's say he plays a full season, basically at this level, that's a 3-win player.
Yeah. 2.5 to 3-win player, I think.
And he's 26. He, you know, just turned 26 before the season started.
Mm-hmm.
He can play shortstop and he can play center field. And if you need him to, he can play pretty much anywhere else. Like, that's insanely valuable.
He has played every position on the diamond in his career except first base and catcher.
Yeah, and
he's even pitched. I mean,
yeah, exactly. It's, you know, you look at. I was trying to illustrate your point as well. It's not just not getting everyday reps, but he didn't get like. I'm trying to find, like, pull up his minor league numbers if you guys can on Baseball Reference, and I'm trying to sequence together where and when and at what age he got his at-bats. It's really hard because he was at like 3 or 4 levels every year for like 4 years in a row and changed organizations. And it's like he was first called up at age 22, I want to say, to the Rangers. He got 57 plate appearances in 25 games, which means he was not starting or playing every day. He was getting 2 PAs per game he was appearing in.
And then he went to Chicago and still got more at-bats that year, but still.
Yeah, but that's at age 22, and I'm trying to identify, like, at that point, like, you look at how many at-bats he'd had above high A at that point. It's a full season. He had 400 PAs at double A, I guess, as a 21-year-old in 2012. Like, that's not a ton. And then he got another, you know, 50 games at triple A, and he was up. And he clearly hadn't mastered hitting yet. Like, he had a 700 OPS at triple A, but he is fast and plays a million positions. And so the Rangers, who were a contending team at the time, thought we could use him as a 25th man on the bench to solve those defensive problems. But that's not what you do to, like, develop the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that the White Sox finally just basically sent him down and gave him 2 full seasons at AAA, you know, still only at age 24 and 25,
yeah,
which is older than you'd like, but if you basically say he got 0 bat development for 2 or 3 years in his early 20s, because he just got like blitzed up. I don't think it's that weird. I think it's impressive that he's like stuck with it to the point where it didn't just like totally demoralize him and he was able to put this together. But I don't think this would have, if you go back in time and told, like, you had those excerpts from like Jason Parks or whatever, you go back and people who scouted his tools. I mean, the dude's a burner. He's not like, you know, Jose Altuve, like ripped for a little guy, but he's not D. Gordon, Billy Hamilton, the bat's going to get knocked out of your hands either.
He's a lot stronger. I'll tell you, he looks a lot stronger in person than I would have expected. Like, he's probably, he's like 5'8". You know, that's what he's listed at, and I'd say that's pretty close to accurate. But he's pretty stout when he's in street clothes, you know, when he's not in full uniform. He's stronger than you would expect out of a small utility player type. I'll say that for sure.
Well, yeah, and he's shown some pop. And what's cool is these are anecdotal, but I've seen him handle premier velocity. Like, he got a pinch hit when I was at a game. He got a pinch hit single off of Aroldis Chapman. That's as hard as someone's going to throw. I saw him pull a home run off of Luis Severino on a 98 mile an hour fastball. I saw just recently he got another single off a dude who's basically just a flamethrower, and I'm totally blanking on it, which is, you know, if you're worried about a guy being too slight and small for power, like, that's not this dude. I mean, I'm not calling him to put up a 30 home run season or whatever it is, but if he hadn't gotten hurt, he's looking like he'd have 12 or 15 as a guy who can handle short and center. I mean, that's really good.
Yeah, the power does seem to have developed a little bit surprisingly. The thing that I am kind of blown away by is he had, coming into the season, he had 9 extra base hits in his entire career. And he has 8 home runs this year. Right. He had 9 extra base hits across 313 plate appearances or whatever it was.
The other downside, and you were talking about how he fits with a future team, the other downside to him getting as much service time while he wasn't developing as he did is that, you know, he's ARB eligible next year, and he's going to be a free agent after the 2020 season. I guess, you know, he's not a bad guy to go year to year with.
Yeah.
And you see where you're at in after 2019 maybe, and maybe you talk about extending him then if he's basically shown himself to be, I don't know, he's a better version of Javier Baez right now, frankly. At least for now, this season anyway. It's 1 year, but, that's somebody who, as like the super sub, or you just slot him in. I mean, who knows what happens with Tim Anderson? Maybe you just slot him in as your everyday shortstop. Like, we're in a new golden age of shortstops, but like, he'd be one of the better shortstops in the American League, I would think.
Yeah, you would think so. And the thing is that he can, you know, I mentioned the utility type because that's the obvious thing. But if you've got a team, you know, with mashers and with like elite level skills all over the field, like, say, you know, you're doing some fantasy roster projections where you're like, okay, well, we've got Moncada at second base and we've got Jimenez and Rutherford in the outfield and we've got Berger in there, we've got Collins in there. Not every starting player on your roster for a championship team is going to be a freaking all-star. So there's no, and you know, Garcia has shown that he can be like a really good second division starter and even like center field. So maybe you haven't been able to solve your center field issue, and you know, maybe there's not, the free agency doesn't work out, or they don't spend on free agency. You've got these, if you have a team full of really good hitters and he can be a second division starter on a winning team, I don't think there's any reason he can't.
And there's no, like, this isn't fun to think about, but, you know, maybe Moncada, when he has that collision with, let's say it's 2020 and you're competing and Moncada has that collision with Willie Garcia and like tears his ACL, mm-hmm. like Larry Garcia is your starting second baseman now and he's going to be really good.
Yeah, that depth matters. I mean, we learned that so much over the past couple of years with the White Sox when they had a couple of stars and then just a bunch of really terrible players.
Yeah.
You know, that having guys around like him or like Yolmer or, you know, to a certain extent, guys like Matt Davidson or like Aaron Bummer in the bullpen. It's like having guys who aren't stars enough to, like, command playing time but are more than competent to fill certain roles is hugely important.
Well, and I want to – gosh, I just was looking at this. Here it is. This, going back to this graph that I want to give it proper credit. The three, he's a good White Sox Twitter guy, and I'll see if I can track it down later. But he put together a graph of from 2011 to 2015, number of 400 plate appearance and negative 0.5 or worse FWAR seasons. The White Sox had 10. Nobody else had, and they were, and theoretically they were trying to compete.
What was the year's range again?
2011 to 2015. Okay. So I guess, I mean, going into 2013, I think they thought they were contending.
Yeah.
Obviously it exploded. 2014, I don't think they thought they were contending just yet. But they did sign, that was 2014. I think that they considered themselves like a soft rebuild or whatever, but, you know, and 11, I think they thought they were contending too because they were coming off of 2010, and they brought all those guys back. So like you had all but one of those seasons, they're trying to win, and they had 10, like basically 400 plate appearances is just shy of like, I mean 600 is like an everyday starter.
Yeah.
So, but basically a full time job. To 10 dudes who were not just like barely sub replacement, but like significantly sub replacement. They had 10 of those. Second place. Do you want to know who the second most was over that entire window?
My guess. Wait, the number or the team?
Well, if you can do the team, that's even more impressive. But I was going to say the number.
So the White Sox had 10, right?
Yeah.
I'll say the second worst had 4, and I'm going to say it was the Phillies.
This may even just be the AL, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Then it's Oakland, right?
It is 4. It was the Royals and Tigers both had 4 such seasons. Oh. the A's only had 2, but okay. Nobody else, you know, so it was 4 and then, you know, or better. That's insane.
It is.
If you have dudes like Yulmer as of 2017, Yulmer may have been one of those dudes.
Probably.
2015, he might have been one of those dudes.
I guess I don't have F4 up, but he's been worth 1.7 B-War this year, which brought his career wins above replacement up to 1.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, there was a possibility that he was one of those guys when he had the 400 plate appearance season. And It's a real thing. And like you said, not every player on your team is going to be a star, and not every player is going to work out. Like if some of those guys bust and you want a league average regular or maybe slightly better, you know, and you've got one sitting there who can play pretty much every position, that's pretty cool. Not to belabor the point any further. In terms of how do these guys slot in for the future, Avisail Garcia has banged out like a whole bunch more multi-hit games in the last week.
Yeah.
I guess other than that slump where he may have been playing hurt, he's hitting .316 still.
I do wonder. I don't even really know which side of the coin I fall on for this, but I do wonder what if they're going to look into or entertain the thought of trading him in the offseason, or even if they did, what his market would be. You know, as someone coming off of a really good season after several really bad seasons who doesn't provide any defensive value or real base running value. I just am curious what his future holds after a season like this and how the organization thinks of him now.
I mean, again, this is a guy who just turned 26 in June. He, you know, I was as down as anybody on him. FRIA has liked his defense for several years now and likes it again. So if you, I mean, I don't just buy a defensive metric straight up, but no. If you accept that he lost some weight and got some of his speed back, he has a huge arm. There's no reason physically looking at him why he can't be a solid corner outfielder defensively, right? Like,
for sure.
Like he should be able to. I know in the past he hasn't, but like
I think he's improved, and like, I just don't know what you project as his true talent with the bat at this point.
Yeah, it's really tough to say. I do agree with you. Like, at the very least, like, if his bat, if what we've seen out of his bat this year is more or less what he's going to be for the next couple of years, then I think that that is to the point where even if his defense is below average, I don't think it's below average enough to where it, like, tanks his value entirely. Especially if FRAA likes him, you know, every
defense... It's not like J.D. Martinez.
Exactly, exactly. Like, every defensive metric has its faults, but, like, I think that, you know, if you're performing to a certain level offensively, then it outweighs any defensive shortcomings you might have. And especially if you have, you know, obviously in a really good defensive center fielder. I know that FRAA does – well, FRAA likes Engle too, maybe more than some others do. But if you surround him with the right type of defense, it kind of helps make up for that regardless of how good he is there. And it's just a matter of if the bat's hanging around, which – you know, I've joked many times this season about how long it's going to take for me to be a full believer in Abascal's bat, you know, being real. And I still, you know, he has 410 plate appearances of 126 OPS plus right now. And I'm still like, man, right. What if he just goes in the tank again next season? What if he just goes back to being old Avi? I don't know. I'm afraid of it. So, I think that anyone talks about, like, oh, maybe they should extend Avi. I think that's super premature, and I think the White Sox probably agree with that. I don't have any fear that they're going to give him some outlandish contract. I mean, he's not a free agent until 2020. I think it's just kind of wait and see mode with him. Like, there's no reason to, like, you don't have to make a decision on what Avi is for the future White Sox right now or this offseason or even next year. You just keep letting him play and keep seeing how well he performs and then just keep reassessing as it pushes farther down the line.
If he does this again, let's say he hits 300 something again next year. At the end of next year, maybe you think about it. And then that depends on what his demands are.
Yeah.
You know, because it could be that his demands are low enough that you're like, well, even if he regresses again, we won't regret it because we'll just, you know, we'll lock in the chance that he stays, you know, borderline all-star caliber player.
Yeah.
And, you know, we buy the downside too. I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe Abascal says, I'm an all-star. I'm going to hit free agency at age 29 or whatever, and I'm going to see if I can, you know, send eight generations of grandkids to college or whatever it is. Like, I don't know. it's really fascinating. I mean, his BABIP right now for the year, I mean, early in the year when he was, you know, his BABIP was like 450 or whatever. I was like, okay, well, like, this has to change. But right now it is, oh gosh, I just had it. It's 376 for the year, which is high, but it's not that high for a dude who runs well out of the box. And yeah. He looks different. Like, I know this sounds crazy, but, like, you see, even just watching game one yesterday, you could see him shortening his swing and almost, you know, just serving the ball where the defense was giving him an opening, which I know it's hard to control where you're hitting the ball, but you can a little bit. I mean, I think that good hitters can in certain situations. They can certainly shorten their swing or try to swing for opposite field specifically in certain situations. And even though we talked several podcasts ago about with James about how the plan was, like, you know, the plan for Avi this year that has been working so well. It's like, well, what about if pitchers, like, execute perfect pitches on him on the inside part of the plate? His single yesterday in game one was on a fastball right on the inside corner, and he pulled his hands in and he still roped it up the middle. And I think Steve Stone was saying, like, last year that's a Benetti was like, do you think he makes contact with that? And he says, yeah, but it's, you know, a ground ball to third. And I think it's interesting. Like, it's so hard to bet on a guy getting luck on balls in play. But there's components to his style that could make – I mean, okay, maybe he's a 290 hitter instead of a 315 hitter.
Yeah.
And that's – that probably shades his line down to more – so if his secondary skills stay the same, then he hits 290, 340, 460. That's not great, but it's definitely playable.
For sure. And I think that what I was trying to look up was his hit rates, you know, because you're talking about the BABIP. And honestly, that's not really changed either. Like, the amount of soft, medium, and hard contact he makes. Like, he's making 2% more hard contact this year than he did in previous years. And that's the kind of stuff that you see. When you see the BABIP go up, you're like, that's one of the things I think that helps tell whether it's fluky or not, is how hard are you hitting the ball, you know? Is he just hitting rockets all over the place and that's why his BABIP is so high, or is he, you know, dinking and dunking these balls that are just out of the reach of the defense and getting kind of lucky? So maybe he is getting kind of lucky, but I do agree with you where the eye test, I think, it tells a different story. It shows a difference in his approach in certain situations. And also, he's shown the ability to do what we've been screaming at him to do for years, which is sell out for power at times. And, you know, and that's where, like, you look. I mean, his pull percentage this year is 46%, which, and his career average was 38%. So he's still not just, if you look at his spray charts, they're not as different. But, you know, when you see the power, I mean, he has tied his career high in homers so far this year, and that's with missing some time with injuries. He has as many home runs this year as he did 2 years ago in 200 fewer plate appearances. And that just shows his approach changing a little bit in that regard.
Well, I also think that, you know, I don't know if that hard hit contact or whatever it is takes into account, like, the nature of the contact. I know that famously, I don't know if you remember Eric Campbell of the Mets. He was a guy that they kept beating their heads against a wall trying to make it work. And one of the things I think was cited as, like, well, he had good exit velocity or something like that. It's like, yeah, he hit it 100 miles an hour on the ground at the shortstop over and over again.
Yeah, like, so it doesn't show if it's a line drive, like, or ground ball.
It doesn't matter if he's hitting screaming grounders to short. Like, okay, that means he can't beat them out as infield singles then. Like, fantastic. So, I mean, it's not perfect, and it's...
No, it's not.
Who knows? He'll probably... As soon as I'll probably talk myself into hyping him up, and then he'll be terrible next year.
That's he's just going to wait until we buy in.
Yeah, exactly. They'll pass on a big free agent for the 2019 season, and because they have him.
We don't need Bryce Harper. We've got Avisail. Come on.
I mean, Harper, it's like Yankees 1 and then Dodgers 2, right? Like, is there any?
I mean, people are assuming
maybe the Nets come in with the best offer.
I was gonna say people are assuming he's gonna leave Washington, but it's not like Washington is like the Royals. You know, they spend money. They gave this an insane contract years ago to Jason Worth that surprisingly ended up not being as bad as people thought it was gonna be at the time. You know, I don't think other than. I don't know. I feel like people are like assuming he's going to leave and assuming the Nationals aren't going to spend enough to keep him. And I don't really understand why. They're not a poor team. You know, they're not a small market team.
I think their owner, at least as of when I last checked this or heard this statistic, their ownership group is the wealthiest of any team in the majors. It's just a matter of what they've demonstrate willingness to spend, but they have been. I mean, they've signed. I mean, they were the high bidders for Scherzer, and he's Harper's like a new ish thing. But they extended Strasburg. Like, I know that Harper wants to hit free agency, but that doesn't mean the Nationals can't give him the best offer in free agency.
Exactly.
But maybe this is kind of jumping ahead, but I'm happy to do this. Like, people have started to. You know, not just random, like, Twitter bums. I know, like, James had an article about, like, you know, what is the lineup?
Call them Twitter bums. You're talking about our main readership and listening base.
Hold on. I didn't say I am saying within Twitter there are bums.
Oh. But they. I'm not saying, you're not calling our listeners bums because
not at all. Like they're willing to put up with. They're willing to indulge my ego and listen to this nonsense. And I get, or they could just be putting up with me to listen to you, which is a rational
definitely
choice.
Not the case.
But like, you know, James had his piece and he had Manny Machado at third base, and he even said in the piece, like, look, you know.
Pine this guy.
Just going on a limb here. It's an example of like they are going to have room in the budget to add a big free agent or two, and this is a position of need. And so you know why not? But I do wonder. I don't. I've just never assumed. You know, obviously, I just assume Kershaw and Harper are going to go to LA and New York or Washington or some place that's going to be willing to spend the like $400+ million that
yeah.
Like, you know, seems merited. But there are, and I wrote about this recently too, there are other interesting names here. I mean, Donaldson will be 33. It'll be interesting to see how he's doing then. He'll be a free agent. Guys like AJ Pollock are going to be available. Charlie Blackman's going to be available. So there's going to be like all-star level guys.
Who aren't the $400 million guys.
No, I mean, Charlie Blackman will be 32. Pollock will be 31.
I love Pollock. I worry about his injuries, but I love that guy. He's super underrated. Everyone in Arizona is underrated because nobody ever thinks about the Nationals. I always say all the time, sorry for the tangent, that I think Paul Goldschmidt would be like the face of baseball if he played anywhere other than Arizona.
It could be. It could very well be. I mean, he's super good. You know, these are just, you know, if the big teams are going to be chasing after those guys, you could do what the Tigers like to do or have done in the past and to some positive and some negative results where they kind of jump the market and they say, okay, we want the third or fourth best dude and we're going to sign him for a contract we think is fair. Because a lot of time, you know, sometimes like, oh, we're going to wait for such and such to set the market. But the Tigers jumped the market on Victor Martinez way back when on that first contract that worked out really well. They did that with Jordan Zimmermann.
Which I think didn't work out quite as well.
No, it didn't. But it is something you can do. They don't have to go in order, you know, like that. It doesn't always have to be that way. So, you know, you could say, all right, there's going to be this crazy bidding war for, I don't know, for Harper. We're just going to sign Charlie Blackman to like a 5-year deal that like makes sense for us.
Yeah.
Maybe you do that. I don't know. Or something similar. But I do think it's interesting that the White Sox are going to have a cheap team. Like they're by definitionally, that's what you're doing when you try to make as much homegrown team as possible.
Yeah.
Frees up money for other stuff. I mean, John Lester is a good example of that also.
Yeah. I just hope they freaking do it. You know, they, you know, I feel like if we had this podcast and this platform, you know, 5-6 years ago, whenever Sale was coming up and after when they traded for Eaton and stuff like that, we'd been like, all right, well now let's supplement their roster with some big money free agents. And we were saying that once we did kind of get a platform and it never happened. I joked, whether it was in writing or on this podcast about the year I was screaming for them to get that protected top 10 pick so they could sign one of the top outfielders, and then they never did. I feel like this plan is laid out far enough in the future that I'm more hopeful that when this core comes around, and presuming this core gets to the point where you can start to envision contending, that they're willing to spend. I'm more hopeful that they're willing to spend than I was previously. Maybe that's a fool's errand. You know, the White Sox are historically cheap in free agency, but it's at least something to consider and to hope for.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing is you don't have bad money until you acquire it. And as it stands, I mean, I could pull up the spreadsheet with their contract commitments, but I'm pretty sure off the top of my head, like, the only real contract commitments they're going to have after next season. I mean, I guess Shields is around for one more year.
Shields is around through next season. Yeah.
Which is amazing.
I know. I just realized that like a month ago, I was looking at something. I go, wait, they have one more year of Shields.
I know.
Jesus Christ.
I know.
You know, just make him the highest paid just make him the highest paid bullpen coach in baseball or something, you know.
Right? But they, let me see, for 2018 they got Shields, $21 million. Abreu's got his situation.
Although isn't it at only $10 million for Shields, because isn't San Diego picking up part of that?
They're picking up somewhere between like 30% and 50% of it, yeah. So something, or maybe even higher. But yeah, Abreu's probably going to be around like $13 or $14 million. Avi's like probably $6 or $7 million ARB number, maybe a little higher. And that's 2018. 2019, they've got some buyouts. Abreu's like ARB 3 and Abbotsfield's ARB 4, and like that's it.
Yeah.
So until you like acquire bad money, even these guys who are going to be hitting, I guess Rodon will be like an ARB 2 guy, but like none of this is really prohibitive at all. Like you don't even have the bigger deals that you used to have. You don't have Danks clogging up your stuff. You don't have
Don or Rios.
What? Oh,
or Don or Rios.
Oh, I heard you say. I thought you were making like a gonorrhea pun with Rios' name. Don or Rios. Got it. Okay. No, you don't have those. You don't even have those like inside, or those mid-level albatrosses, or just like, this is way more money than you want. Like you could go out and get someone and hell, overpay. Free agency isn't a bargain.
And that's the thing. That's the thing that drives me the most nuts is you'll see in free agency discussions, you'll see, I'll use Charlie Blackmon as an example because you brought him up a few times. They'll say like, oh, I would do, fans will say, oh, I would do Charlie Blackmon for $60 million. I wouldn't do Charlie Blackmon for $75 million. And it's like, what? What are you – it's not your money, and your goal isn't to win the dollar per war playoffs. You know, if you spend $15 million more on a guy to help you win a World Series or even just win a damn division – and he helps you do that, but he wasn't worth the contract. Who cares? That's awesome that he helped you, even if he didn't help you to the level that his paycheck called him to help.
Well, right, and that's the thing is, like, this is a weird system. This isn't an intuitive system at all. Players on the first 6 years of team control are way underpaid.
Yes.
If they stick around long enough to hit free agency, theoretically they start to like make it back on the other side.
Yes.
Because they're overpaid. That's how it works. And so if you have a team that's like 20 of these guys are under, you know, on either pre-ARB or ARB deals, yeah, you're going to overpay for those free agents. But guess what? Like, you should. I'd argue you have like a moral obligation to go do that, because otherwise you're just robbing people.
Yeah.
Like, that's screwed up. Like, you know, yeah, and, you know, hats off to you for being clever. And, you know, like you said, the goal isn't the dollars per war. I mean, some teams, I guess it is or whatever. But I can quote Jared Seidler quoting Tom Tippett at Sabre Seminar. Like, if I build a perfectly fiscally efficient 85-win team, I have failed at my job.
Yeah. There you go.
Like, I mean, maybe that's your goal or whatever, and as an intellectual exercise, is like a simile thing. Yeah, it's like super interesting to try to figure out the most cost effective way of doing business. But like, you're trying to win 90 something games. You're not trying to win 83.
Yeah. No, definitely, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. It's going to be interesting. I mean, this offseason I don't think is going to be super interesting for the White Sox, because they've traded away everyone of value, and I feel like any free agents they sign will kind of be veteran stopgaps that they'll try to flip at the deadline again next year. But the free agency 2 years from now will definitely be something to watch. So we've somehow been going for more than an hour already today. It doesn't feel like that, and there's a ton that we haven't talked about. I did want to mention Carlos Rodon. You know, he had a pretty good start yesterday, Monday, in the doubleheader. Ended up walking, I think, four, but I think two or three of them came in the one inning that he really ran into trouble early on. He's missing bats at the rate that everyone thought he would and hoped he would. And he has cut down on the walks for the most part. I think he's put together a really good stretch. Before that twin start, I think his last four starts were against, like, the Red Sox, Astros, Indians, and Dodgers. And, you know, all four ended up as positive results. Have you liked what you've seen from him since he came back from injury, particularly his last few starts?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's not much not to like. And even yesterday, watching his start, I thought he was getting squeezed a little bit. He had three walks. I think, you know, who knows how those at-bats play out if some of those close pitches go the other way. The year-long numbers aren't there because he started a little rough. I mean, I guess his ERA is solid. This is the third year in a row where it looks like he's going to finish on like a really good streak to end the year, which is great. I don't know what they can do to get him to hit the ground running next year, as opposed to, you know, it's great that he improves as the year goes on, but it'd be nice if it wasn't like, you know, back to square one every time the year started up again.
Yeah.
Maybe they make a different decision with him with the injury if they're trying to contend or something like that this year. I like what I'm seeing, and so much of it with him, his stuff is just, it's like Kopech as well, where his stuff is so good that you don't need to look at a million factors to see how he's doing. Like Rodon, if he's getting first pitch strikes and he's getting ahead of hitters, he's going to destroy
it. It's as simple as that. It really is.
Yeah. And there isn't much else. I mean, yeah, sure. Like, it'd be cool if he got better with his changeup or whatever, and he could paint the corners a little more effectively. Maybe that would be, but like, if he's getting first pitch strikes, that's the difference between him being like a volatile fourth starter and being like a high end three and a low end two.
Yeah.
Him getting another grade of command on the fastball and getting another grade on his change is the difference between him being a two and a one. I think the first step is pretty attainable. I don't know if the second step will ever get there. It's just hard to control stuff as lively as his. You can count the guys who have his stuff and can command it on one hand. But certainly in the starting rotation anyway. I'm confident penciling him in as a mid rotation starter moving forward, and there's room for more.
It would be awesome if he grew into a solid high end two. I still think that there's a chance that he can get to that point where he's performing at like, I mean, it's an easy comparison because they came up through the same organization, although one was a lot more highly regarded prospect than the other. But if he like fills that Jose Quintana role where, you could see a scenario, you can dream of a scenario where in 3 years, the White Sox are sitting there with Michael Kopech as their one and Carlos Rodon as their two. And you're like, this is awesome. This is a great 1-2 punch in your rotation.
Totally. And so much of, you know, it doesn't go as easily as, I'm trying to think of a team that ever had like a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, and a 5 in terms of like the profile also in sequence. They're really good teams that just have a bunch of like number twos and threes. If you have like, if your rotation's all like threes, your rotation's amazing.
Yeah.
I think if he is like a number two caliber guy, you're in really, really good shape moving forward. I'm excited about what we're seeing, and it's just going to be a matter of seeing it over the course of all season. And that's not to say everybody's got bad starts and bad months, but it's been weird, the first half, second half thing with him for a while.
And it was a bummer this year. Obviously, we missed a whole, 3 months of getting to watch him pitch and some development time. But it's nice that as much concern as there was in that first half of the season about his injury and the kind of, like, mysterious circumstances around it, that he came back and hasn't shown ill effects and has just kind of picked up that development right where he left off. And I hope that, we were so high on Rodon toward the end of last year because he got off to that, or he finished the year so strong. And then, like you said, this year we kind of had to hit the reset button because of that injury. And it almost took a year away where we were hoping, at next year at this time, we hope to be where we had previously hoped he would be at this time this year. Did I say that in a way that made sense? That was really weirdly phrased.
Oh, I understand what you're trying to say. So yeah, for sure. I mean, quick hits. Otherwise, Abreu's having the second best year of his career at this point,
which is awesome. And I did want to say again, I throw in the caveat of small sample size reporter who's not in the clubhouse every day, but like, he just seems so freaking happy in the clubhouse all the time. Like, he is just constantly joking around. Like, in just the 2 days I was there, he's just constantly interacting with Moncada and Yolmer, who's interacting with everyone. And he seems to really enjoy that. Like, it was either you or James who coined the phrase that I've used a couple times, that like big brother role where you're like,
yeah,
you're old enough to be somewhat of a mentor figure, but not too old to the point where you can't still relate to these guys. And like, and you saw it. I mean, we haven't even talked about that Reynaldo start and how Abreu basically was like, dude, don't be a hero. He said that. Yeah. He said that in the post game interview. He said, I told him, don't be a hero. Or maybe Ricky said that he said that. But anyway, you know, we've talked a lot about.
Lopez wasn't forthright with his injury. Well, and understandably so. And because they were, I think it was like it sounded like almost a formalistic thing. They were like, how's your arm? He's like, my arm is fine.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. And he started, and so Ricky and Herm came out and they said, how's your arm? And he said, my arm's fine. And so they started to walk away, and Abreu looked at
Lopez. Ask him about his side, though.
Well, he just goes, he looks at Lopez, and he goes, is everything okay? And Lopez goes, well, my side hurts. And that's when Abreu was like, dude, don't be a hero. You're going to have a lot of opportunities. Let's be smart about this. And he yelled. They were, like, at the foul line in Arlington, like, walking back to the dugout, and he yelled back. He's like, come back here. His side hurts. We need to get him out of the game. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, and we've talked a lot about his relationship with Moncada and how much he loves Moncada and how he picked him up from the airport when he arrived in Chicago. And I think that's an obvious connection. They played for the same team in Cuba. They're from the same place. But any of those, it seems kind of simplistic to say the players who don't speak English, but that is a really important role to have for them because they're in this new environment and not all of their teammates speak the same language as him. But even for guys who do speak English, like Nicky Delmonico, or even like, I guess Saladino's a little older, or Engel or anyone like that, he has become this mentor where baseball, you know, baseball has a language all of its own where you don't need to speak the same language necessarily to influence someone else on the field. And it seems like he's doing that with everyone and not just the Spanish language speaking players.
Yeah. And you think about, it sounds like a little thing maybe on the surface, but if you think about, yeah, you know, Lopez's side is hurt and it sounds like he'll be fine. But what's scary about stuff like that is if a pitcher is pitching through an injury, even not to his arm, there's no way it doesn't affect his mechanics. There's no way you're not trying to compensate for that weakness or that pain by
no matter where it's at in the body,
movement somehow. And that is a very easy way to get injured. And it makes you wonder about some of these organizations who are it's pretty public about how they want their pitchers pitching through injuries. And it's an old school mentality, but I think it's been proven to lead to longer DL stints. And, you know, and it's one thing to be, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example of a guy who's like comfortable in his role. I bet if like Rodon, I'm pretty sure feels very comfortable self-reporting. I don't think he doubts the organization's trust in him or that he's going to lose his rotation spot or something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's not like a psycho. I mean, I'm sure there's some guys out there who are going to, even if they're, you know, let's say they were the ace for the Astros right now where the playoff spot's clinched and you only have like negatives to pitching through injury. There's some guys who are wired to be like, no, screw it. I need to pitch every single inning no matter what.
Like Jake Peavy type guy.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a great example. But if you discourage – I mean, you think about rookies or something like that or younger guys or who are being discouraged from self-reporting because they don't want to be seen as weak or soft or something like that. And you can get really ugly results. And I'm not going to name names, but I'm sure you guys can connect the dots in some of that.
I don't know. Yeah, the bullpen's terrible.
Bullpen's an adventure.
I do like, I mean, there are some guys who you just feel bad for because they're just completely overmatched. Like, we've talked a couple times about Brad Goldberg.
Oh, yeah, he got sent down today. Yeah. Holland looks done.
Miguel Gonzalez, on the other hand, who we haven't brought up, has had some pretty solid results.
It's amazing.
For, like somehow just gutted through, like, questionable stuff against like the freaking Dodgers, and then the Rangers. I do wonder if, I mean, we've got about a week left for them to try to sell them to a team that wants that needs some rotation depth before the playoffs. I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
I'm not sure. I was actually looking at that. I mean, he's had his last three starts have all been amazing. He had that horrible, horrible bomb against the Red Sox, and his three starts before that were amazing. I mean, this is a guy who has a pretty long track record where if he's healthy is something approximating, like a league average pitcher with bad peripherals. And, you know, at a certain point, ERA is like oddly more predictive than the peripherals are. I think as in some cases, you know, because it indicates there's something he's doing that's not necessarily being captured by strikeouts and walks. Obviously, I'd rather, all things being equal, I'd much rather bet on the guy with good peripherals.
Yeah.
But, this is a guy with, he's got 800 major league innings. He has a strikeout to walk ratio of 2, which is not great. And, a career ERA plus of 105. Like, unless you think he's declined in some material way, that's kind of who he is.
Yeah.
And there are certainly, I was just poking around, I mean, the fact that there are still so many teams hanging around in this AL wildcard race, I think it'd be weird if somebody didn't want to give him a go. I mean, like, JC Ramirez just went on the DL for the Angels. I don't see how he wouldn't be a big improvement for the Angels. I'm not sure what you get from them. I'm not sure if you care how much you get from them, as long as it's something.
Yeah. I mean, it'll probably be one of those, like, player to be named later type deals, especially at this point in August where you're literally only getting a month of him, which is a lot less than 2 months or 2.5 months or anything like that. You're getting a month of him.
But here's the thing, too. Like, you look at the Angels specifically, right? Like, oh, yeah, they lost a starter. Right now, it's not just Ramirez, though. They're still missing Alex Meyer, Garrett Richards, Matt Shoemaker, and Nick Tropiano.
Yeah, they have been decimated.
I don't even know who the next man up is. They've got four dudes, one of whom I've never heard of. I don't know who Parker Bridwell is.
He's played – I keep hearing his name mentioned. Hasn't he been pretty good?
I'm sure he has.
I don't know if I could name an Angel starter right now with all those guys hurt.
I know Skaggs and Haney are guys who were once prospects who've had some health problems. Yeah, of course. Parker Bridwell has an ERA of 2.92. He was a ninth round draft pick by the Orioles. I don't know how he got to the Angels. He was no offense, Parker. Like, you're doing better than I am.
Yeah.
He was traded for a player to be named or cash before the season in April.
There you go.
Like,
and how the hell do the Orioles keep giving away starters who end up being good elsewhere?
They are strange.
They're the worst at that.
The Orioles are kind of like mirror universe White Sox, where they're really good at evaluating and coaching up hitters. Like, Jonathan Scope is low-key putting up like an MVP caliber season.
Oh, I know, for my fantasy team.
Yeah, they get guys like Trey Mancini. They get pick up like post-bust guys like Tim Beckham. They fixed Chris Davis one. Like, it's just, it's nuts. They can just, they're good with bats. And then they are the opposite of that with arms. It's really funny.
Yeah.
There are teams, I mean, the Twins are, bless them, are still in it. They're down.
They're
down Santiago. Yeah, like, there's Dietrich Enns is even hurt for the Twins. Like, the Mariners.
The Rangers were left for dead a few weeks ago, and now are, I think you tweeted out just earlier today, they're one of the five teams in the American League with a positive run differential this year. You know?
Yep, and they're two games back on the wild card now or something like that.
Yeah, it's literally every Mariners, team except the White Sox, Tigers, and Athletics.
And I think the Blue Jays have played their way back into it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, the – here's – all right, for the Mariners – just if you go to Roto World's depth charts, they have, you know, a layout, American League, yeah. National League, your team's depth chart. There is a red box next to the name of pitchers, starting pitchers 1 through 4 on the Mariners right now. Yeah. Giovanni Gallardo and Ariel Miranda are the survivors for that rotation. And
that's not much of a survivor. Giovanni Gallardo, I mean.
Like the Yankees could use him, even though they're pretty safe. Like they could use him, certainly if they want to spare their bullpen a little bit. I mean, Gonzalez has shown he can go deep into games when he's right.
Guys, and if they clinch at some point, you keep arms like Severino fresh for the playoffs, something like that. You know,
the Dodgers may have just lost Alex Wood to go along with Darvish. Let me see. Yeah, he's got some inflammation. He hasn't pitched very well lately. So their 1, 2, and 3 have some boxes next to their names. There's a lot of teams who could use them to varying degrees. Even if he doesn't, you know, he just protects some of the younger guys for a while. But he's pitched great, and I've been happy for him. Giolito's coming up, which is exciting. Kopech pitched well, but not like his world-destroying self in his AAA debut because he got promoted.
Yes.
Eloy is off to a good but not absurd start in AA.
Zach Collins is in AA now.
Yeah, so there's some end-of-year promotions just to get him a look at the league next year, reward them for their hard work for this season.
Yeah.
But it is exciting. It kind of advances the timetable on those guys in a really immaterial way. I mean, if Kopech's presumably starting next year in AAA, like, that means his major league arrival time is sometime next year, probably?
You would hope. I mean, even if it's not till September, I think that if he progresses in AAA the way that he did this year in AA and the way that his career trajectory is going, it'd be cool to see him. I was going to ask James or someone. I wonder if they follow the path with him where they bring him up and have him make his first couple appearances out of the bullpen, or if they just go straight starter. It seems like with him, the workload is such that you don't want him like fluctuating from like his throw days and stuff like that. So maybe he's straight starter right from the beginning. But I do wonder what the plan is for him once we get to the point of promotion.
I don't know. I mean, obviously there's the long track record of guys being broken in either staying in the rotation or from the bullpen. I don't think there's a reason why you couldn't. But the injuries that Kopech has had, I don't think any of them are like, one injury was kind of a fluke thing and the other was like a PED thing.
Yeah.
That's the reason his workload has been low. In a weird way, I'm almost like relieved. I feel like that kind of spared his arm some work.
For sure.
For reasons that were not deleterious to his permanent outlook. Especially coming out, you know, the second half, his last like 6 starts or whatever in AA were just like evil. They were so good.
Yeah.
And with pitchers more so than hitters, because it's not a reactive thing, like his stuff's insane. And if he can locate it at all, that's, you know, other than sequencing and some, you know, gamesmanship stuff, like, that's kind of what you need to learn is how to command your stuff. So it's not like a hitter where you're like, okay, I really want him to get I want him to get 500 PAs in AA and 500 PAs in AAA. So he can like, he's seen everything and he's slumped and he's ready to handle adversity and adjust. And like, whereas, you know, if Kopech can throw if he can sit 97 when he's going easy and locate it where he wants, I don't know. That's kind of the goal. That's it.
Yeah.
So exciting stuff. I'm excited for Giolito. Earlier this year on Twitter, there was a bold predictions for the remainder of the year tweet. And mine was that Giolito throws a complete game shutout in the majors.
So you got a shot at it.
I got a shot and he's coming up earlier than I thought. So I've got a couple extra shots.
And maybe now that he's with the major league team, we'll get someone to ask him about his love for baking.
Thank you. I've been, somebody's got to, I mean, Christ, I wanted to go to the White Sox game with my wife out in Chicago, but if nobody's going to cover it, like I'll see if I can get some credentials.
There you go. And then you can ask
everyone. get out of the way. Lucas Frost Giolito and I there are going to talk about frosting.
I mean, wouldn't that be something that Jane would – that's Jane's thing, right? Like, couldn't she just go – you could get her credentialed and she could just go and just have like a 10-minute interview with him all about baking.
You know what? I would love that.
Right?
I would love that so much. They would have a great conversation. He seems like a good guy. Jane's not shy, so.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure – it's fun that there's this much to talk about with this team.
Right, with a team 30 – what are they, like 30 to 35 games under 500, and we're August 22nd, and there's like I was – you know, my dad is a big baseball fan, but he's a – and I don't mean this in a degrading way, but he's a simple baseball fan. He doesn't read about baseball. He just likes to watch baseball on TV, and he knows what he enjoys watching and what he doesn't. He's a big Cardinals fan, but he watches a lot of the White Sox because we're in Northern Illinois and they're on TV. And he was just like, I was talking to him when I got home the other day, and he was like, you know, the White Sox team is fun to watch. And I'm like, isn't that weird? I was like, they're so bad, but they're fun to watch. And it's because they're fun bad as opposed to previous seasons when they were depressingly bad. Because you've got this whole big group of guys who are still like trying to prove themselves and trying to further development and make a mark for the next year. And also guys who seem to genuinely enjoy being around each other. And that's, you know, that makes a difference just in the enjoyability. It's like you watch loss after loss pile up, but you stick around. They could be losing like they did to Texas the other night, 17-6 or whatever it was. And if Moncada was playing, you're like, well, I want to watch the next Moncada at bat. Or even in the smaller sense, if Aaron Bummer's coming in the game, I'm curious. I want to watch Aaron Bummer pitch because he's an interesting guy to watch for the future. Just stuff like that. It just keeps it interesting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that Texas game where they got I'm trying to think if there were, what the positives were. There were some positives to take away from that, but like, dude, we just did an hour and a half, and we haven't talked about Delmonico or Moncada. like, Delmonico is still hitting 343, 443, 642.
It's my boy.
With a strikeout-to-walk ratio of basically one. he steals bases also.
But he has no position.
Yeah, that's a bummer. I guess he's not – I'm curious to see where his bat settles in at, like what his true talent level with the bat is, because – he could be a league average first baseman if any of this is real.
Yeah,
because
he could be Eric Hosmer. Why couldn't he be Eric Hosmer?
Hosmer's never had an OPS of 1085.
I'm saying.
No, I mean that's the thing is like how much of this bat is real. He's 24. He's got a really weird prospect path. I don't think he can handle third.
No,
is he just like? Is he like Uber Connor Gillespie who smiles? Like, I don't know what this is.
He's much more, no offense to Connor, but he's much more handsome than Connor.
That's a tough call. They're good looking men. but I could see Delmonico learning corner outfield passably.
Yeah.
I think he's still new to it and he's got some foot speed. Like he runs okay. He's faster than David. He's not like Davidson where like, you know, Davidson's got to stay on the dirt.
Yeah.
But I you know how that fits into your future plans. I'm not sure, but he hits left-handed. He makes contact. He might actually have a little bit of power in there. So, I don't know, man. It's been 80 plate appearances. Anybody can do anything for 80 plate appearances, but it's been interesting. Moncada is still hitting like 175, and his OPS is still 650. So you know.
Yeah, I guess we don't really talk about Moncada because what he's doing is kind of uninteresting. Like he. We're still not worried about him. It'd be cool if he was crushing the ball all over the field or if he was doing a Rafael Devers and hitting walk-off bombs against their arch rival in a pennant race, but that's not happening. So he
did have the walk-off game. But
he did have the walk-off game. He did have the walk-off game. That's a good point. But
no, he's not doing a Delmonico where he just like destroys everything out the gate. I like how many pitches he's taking. I do wish – you know, he took a couple fastballs down the middle for strike three from Nick Turley, which, like, you know, that's not fun to see, but I'm not, like, concerned about his future ability because he guess wrong on those pitches.
Nah, nothing has changed about his development path for me, or nothing about his future prospects has changed based on these 100 plate appearances or whatever he's at.
I would revise my expectation for his eye up.
Yeah, up for sure. Definitely up.
And then otherwise, this is basically what I expected.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, cool. Like you said, we're at an hour and a half. We're at 1:31. So let's call it and talk let's again next week, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. We've got some hopefully some prospect team interviews next week. Should be good.
Yes. All right. Cool. We'll talk to you later, Nick.
My pleasure, Colin.